geared up here. I think we're about ready to go. This is work, and I'm going to take the speaker's privilege. You got to take the lens cap off. I'm going to take the speaker's privilege to change my title a bit. The title that's in the proceedings says I'm going to talk strictly about the incorporation of molecular breeding values. I'm actually going to trace, if you will, an evolutionary process that's been ways that we've changed the Angus carcass evaluation over the last 5 or 6 years. At the outset, I need to acknowledge a couple of people in this process, particularly Sally Northcutt, who every time I have had some crazy harebrained idea, Sally, about what kind of data or a data structure or anything else, Sally's either brought me back to my senses or delivered on my crazy idea. Sally, I thank you. I also wanted to acknowledge Bill Bowman and the rest of the staff at the Angus Association have been very supportive. And I want to acknowledge the Board of Directors of the American Angus Association for at least not buying a new rope. Because there have been several times when it's been my privilege to tell them things that maybe they didn't want to hear. We'll try to, as we go along, we'll try to trace this process for you. Historically, Angus started with a carcass progeny test program a long, long time ago. And that was really the first data they had, was from this carcass evaluation program. Probably, historically, I don't know, but probably originally spins out of ideas that are generated at this kind of a beef improvement meeting 25, 30 years ago. And as technology evolved, we added to that ultrasound, and we in the scientific community and we here in this room and other rooms at the Beef Improvement Federation have been strong proponents of collecting carcass data using ultrasound for a number of years. Sometimes maybe we haven't always had the ultrasound data and the carcass data agree with each other, and the reason those circles aren't right on top of each other is because to reflect that lack of agreement. More recently, we've added to that mix of a molecular value prediction of one sort or another, and so now we have, at least conceptually, 4 or 5 different sources of information, all intended to inform the breeding value of a single trait, or the EPD of a single trait. And the challenge, the big challenge that we undertook is to address concerns that the Angus breeders had. Because Angus breeders were saying, this is all craziness. I can't have three different EPDs for ribeye area that all disagree with each other. I can't have four different EPDs for marbling that don't line up. What am I supposed to do? Well, what we wanted to do was to bring these into some kind of an alignment in a unified evaluation that we call a carcass evaluation, and we predicate that on the economically relevant traits, carcass marbling, carcass ribeye area, carcass fat thickness, so on. So how did this start? This actually started back with motivated by some concerns of some Angus breeders about the data integrity and data structure issues associated with their ultrasound data. And as the ultrasound technology evolved, they became concerned about whether or not that data was useful. And there were individual breeders who were quite willing to say, it's worthless. Throw it all away. And there were others who were less adamant and some who thought it was a very valuable tool and so on. In this process, we changed the way that the steer data was treated, that was collected using ultrasound, and we made the strategic decision, and item four here is really quite important. We made the strategic decision that we were going to use the ultrasound data as indicator traits for the carcass traits. We were going to do a combined analysis, and we were going to use all of that ultrasound data to inform carcass trait analysis. The other thing that we did, based on some work that Karen Meyer did in Australia, actually, is that we looked at the idea that maybe data from bulls, heifers, and steers should be treated as separate traits as opposed to all treated as the same trait. And then another thing that we wanted to do was to reduce the opportunity for what we geneticists want to call selection bias to influence that genetic evaluation. So we wanted to take out of the system, if you will, the opportunity for those animals that had carcass data to be pre-selected based on ultrasound, and then in one way or another, because of the ultrasound information informing which animals went to the carcass part, we wanted to take that source of selection bias out of the analysis. Historically, the Angus carcass data originated from a progeny testing program that used the sire model. Perfectly appropriate strategy. Mimic the way the data was originated. But when we made this migration, we needed to migrate the analysis into a single unified platform, and we did that, and we unified the analysis around what's called an animal model. And there's several advantages to that relative to the sire model. The biggest one of those is you get genetic evaluations for every animal as an outcome of that analysis. We were able to incorporate more pedigree data into this process than had been used historically. We updated the estimates of genetic parameters. That's just it ought to be a standard operating procedure that you just reevaluate, reassess those things periodically. And as you have more data that give you better estimates, you ought to use the better estimates. At that same time, Sally and Bill and the folks at the Angus Association changed the way that they calculated the accuracy values to be better approximations of true accuracy than those that had been used in the past. When you think about, so for marbling, for instance, there's now really five. It's a multiple trait model. There's five traits that go into this. So there's 15 different combinations of information that can come into this to potentially inform a single EPD. When you think about the logistics of making interim EPDs, given that many different kinds of information coming into the analysis, provided some motivation for Angus to actually adopt a suggestion that I made in, I believe, in this committee about 10 years ago, that we go to pseudo-real-time genetic evaluation rather than these sorts of every 6 months genetic evaluations or every year. And at that time, it was every year in a lot of cases. They decided, and I support, but they decided to abandon the interim EPD calculations and simply do the full national cattle evaluation once a week. So when you send in some data this week and it feeds into the pipeline, a week or so later, that data is reflected in the values that you're using to make breeding decisions. So you ultrasound. Historically, you ultrasounded a bunch of cattle in 1st of May. By the time the data wound its way through the system, It missed the June 15th cutoff for the July 1st run of the National Cattle Evaluation, and you had to use the bulls you had based on the information you had for breeding. And then you got your EPDs back after the July 1st run, after you already used those bulls and found out, oh my goodness, he doesn't conform to what I thought he was. I've just made a mistake. Hopefully this helps breeders have current information upon which to base those selection decisions in a manner that is more timely than it's been historically. So what does this joint evaluation look like? For those of you who aren't used to looking at tables, I apologize for my mess. But this table is simply the joint evaluation from carcass marbling and ultrasound. So we have marbling here. Marbling heritability is modestly high, 0.45 or so. That really says to me as a geneticist, if I want to change marbling by selection, I jolly well can do it. The genetic correlations between marbling and the gender-specific traits are fairly high, but there was a time when we talked as though those genetic correlations were one or nearly one. We talked as though our ultrasound estimates were perfect predictors of the carcass traits, and they're not. So that's what those genetic correlations tell us. The other piece of this that was interesting to me, at least, is that ultrasound bull heifer steer trait is all the same trait. Those very high genetic correlations amongst the genders tell me that when I'm doing ultrasound evaluation of marbling, I really am doing the same thing in all three genders. And I just moved through all the little yellow boxes that I forgot I had. So the question, the three trait thing comes about, and why we consider these ultrasound traits different traits comes about because we have at least some evidence that suggests the genetic variances aren't all the same value across all genders, which had been the historical assumption. Same sort of figure for fat depth. Again, we have the genetic correlations between the ultrasound and carcass data here. This value, there's not a lot of data on ultrasound scan data in the database on steers. I don't have a lot of confidence in this row of the data, frankly, but those are the estimates. The bull and heifer data, there's a ton of data here. And that really, those genetic correlations, again, are lower than I think we historically thought they might be. Same sort of general conclusion. When we scan cattle, we're really measuring the same thing in all three genders. And in this case, in the fat depth analysis, it appears that those variances are fairly homogeneous. Ribeye area. Again, reasonable heritability, we can change it by selection. Genetic correlations, less than unity certainly, and low enough to say these are really indicator traits. Again, we measure the same thing, and some concern about whether or not those variances are homogeneous, that is, the traits have the same distribution, or some of them are narrower than others. So then we come to this next step of this evolutionary process, which is really adding the MBVs. The MBV that we're going to talk about today was developed from 1,700 Angus bulls born between 1955 and 2003 and genotyped using the 50K SNP chip that you've heard enough about now to know what is, and some smarter guys than I, Jerry Taylor and Dorian Garrick and others, Donald Negronoff, Brent Woodward were involved in, involved in the development of prediction equations that use that that 50K SNP data to develop an indicator trait, if you will, for each of the carcass traits that we're interested in. I'm going to blame our chairman. I think this is actually right. Mark Tallman's the first person that I ever heard talk about the idea, the conceptual idea, of putting MBVs into an NCE context and incorporating those data into the EPDs directly. And Steve Katchman provided us at a genetic prediction workshop not very long ago conclusive evidence, I think, that we could treat those MBVs simply as correlated traits. So we could build on lots of well-known, well-adopted technology, well-proven technology in that incorporation. We didn't have to go reinvent or invent again some new way to deal with these MBV-type things. So what Sally helped me do, and maybe Sally did and I just carried water, was to do a pseudo national cattle evaluation, a prototype national cattle evaluation, with 42,000 carcass records and nearly 150,000 ultrasound records, 1,900 MBVs, four generation pedigree, and so we use all of this data simultaneously to estimate the necessary variances and covariances to actually do a national cattle evaluation. And then Sally would take the variances and covariances that I have and run those through with these data, their genetic prediction system, calculate a national cattle evaluation, if you will, with these new updated data. So let me show you then some of the key results relative to the variances and covariances. Heritability for the MBVs approached one. And that's comforting. That's as it should be. If the heritability for those molecular breeding, those are supposed to be truly measures of the genetic part. So if they're truly measures of the genetic part, they better have really high heritabilities. And they did, in fact, all approach one. Genetic correlations with the target carcass traits. Sally showed you the same numbers this morning. Those genetic correlations are all reasonably high. That tells us these are reasonably valuable indicator traits. And the correlations with the ultrasound traits, I think the take-home message here is the MBVs are perhaps better predictors of the carcass traits that we're trying to inform than they are of the ultrasound indicator traits. So I want to step back again to this question of the data and the processing strategy. And this graph shows the data flow that comes into the carcass trait NCE over a period that is about the past 8 months or so. And I've color-coded this. The red is molecular data. The green is carcass data. With bull ultrasound and heifer ultrasound. And there are a couple of features on this graph that are striking to me. The first one is we got a big slug of carcass data not very long ago. That's the obvious one. If everything looked like this, I'd be perfectly comfortable with the idea you did an evaluation every 6 months or so, sometime after you got those big slugs of data. But the reality is most of this data comes in relatively small increments, and it comes in almost every week. So do I tell this breeder who just paid for these, in this case MBVs that I'm picking out here, well, I'm sorry, George, but you got to wait until the 1st of July to capitalize on that. And this guy who was much later to the game, well, he's going to get the feedback quicker. Or this breeder who just paid Matt Lane to come and ultrasound his cattle back here, well, you're not going to get any results from that until after our next run. Or do I let these breeders get the feedback back essentially as quickly as they put in their data? I think from a breeder perspective, it's much more appealing to get that information back in a timely manner after you turn in the data. And because this data comes in a continuum, possible exception to Christmas to New Year's, but it comes in a continuum, I think it's obvious, at least to me, that some sort of continuous updating of these EPDs is a warranted practice. So in summary, what do I want you to take home out of this? First, I want you to take home that ultrasound and MBVs are both useful indicators of the economically relevant traits. That is, if you can't collect carcass data, those traits still have value. Second, at this point in time, and until the molecular value prediction piece gets a good bit better than it is today, if you want high accuracy genetic evaluation, it will require you to collect the phenotype on the carcass trait of interest. We have not escaped that necessity. That phenotypic data will also be important because periodically we're going to have to evaluate the efficacy of these molecular breeding value tools, because I believe, and many of us believe, the efficacy of those tools will change over time if we apply selection to those traits. And finally, the constant stream of data poses challenges that now technologically can be overcome with continuous carcass or continuous genetic evaluation systems. And I think that's the end, Mark. I thank you very much for your attention. I thank you very much for your interest in this process. I'd be happy to attempt to entertain any questions. How close are we to an EBV for tenderness? I'm not working on an EBV for tenderness. Okay. I'm not working on an MBV for tenderness. I can tell you that from a technological perspective, that could be very close. I think that's a fair statement. From an implementation perspective, that's dependent on several additional hurdles. I mean, once we have the technology, then we have to have the adoption of that technology. And at this point, at least, I would say that technology is going to be much implemented in a way much like Kurt Van Tassel showed this morning with regard to dairy. And I don't really know where in the... I don't want to put a timeline on that. I'd be nervous about that. So from a technical standpoint, Dick? I think it could be. I think the technology piece is straightforward. Yeah, I think the technology part's straightforward. The implementation, whether or not some breed association decides to publish those values, is a different question. Right. I mean, if they decided they wanted to publish them, it would be done. It could be done very quickly. You know, I've fought with that question in my own mind. the question is, do I see this as the beginning of the end for ultrasound data? And it's a question that I have tossed around in my own mind. I think that's one possible future. I would be concerned about ultrasound. But at this point, because the correlations between, I mean, the current technology, those correlations between the MBV piece and the ultrasound piece aren't particularly high. So they're not a replacement for one for the other. They each, at this point, they each add value to that prediction. Now, and the MBV, if the MBV piece were a perfect predictor, then I think it's the beginning of the end for ultrasound. Or I think it is, you know, I think it's very difficult for ultrasound. But at this point, with current technology, I think there's a continuing role for ultrasound. I would be worried down the road as technology gets better and better. Pardon me?
Right now, we need a combination
of the two that correlate. Right now, we need. I mean, my plea is continued collection of carcass data, and then for breeders to extend that to big groups of animals is going to take collection of one or both of these indicators, and I'm not in a position to recommend one over the other at this point based on these data. I think they both at this point have value. And I don't think it's an either or proposition today. How far away are other breeds from being able to do something similar? It varies. I would. There's pieces of data for Hereford, for instance, that are out there that put them in a position where this is not a huge distance away if they want to go that way. For other breeds, it might be further away. I mean, there's just a variation there that's almost breed specific, and I guess I'll pass the buck to that and say, if you have a particular breed in mind, you probably better go ask the breed exec how far away they are, because I can't give you a very good answer. What's Angus's investment in development of this? it's a lot of money. I mean, this is not something you do on the cheap. But the collection of the carcass data. And it's all based on that carcass data originally. The collection of the carcass data it costs a fair bit of money to progeny test the bull and collect carcass data. So it's not particularly inexpensive.
What's the cost beyond that carcass data that they've done
the deal for? So what's the cost that those chips today represent, round numbers, $200 a sample. So if we were to say it takes 2,000 animals genotyped on a 50K chip to begin the process, so 200 times 2,000 is however much that works out to be, $400,000, if my in-the-head math is right. And then you have to have another set of animals besides those you used to develop the breeding value piece itself in order to assay to do the variance component piece, and that for carcass traits, that ought to be another 2,000 or 3,000 animals. So you're talking about genotype, but those 2,000 or 3,000 animals are genotyped on a much smaller, much less expensive product, presumably, than the 50K chip, although some people might want to do it in the 50K chip kind of technology, depending on a strategy. So, but we could be looking at, you know, minimally another $100,000 in genotyping. So it's not, there's a fair investment required to bring this technology to the breeders. Right. So the formula, there isn't one formula per se. This is the solution to 6 million simultaneous equations and 6 million unknowns. But I think what you're driving at is when the new product comes along. And they come along fairly frequently and fairly rapidly, and there's multiple companies and so on. So as that information complexity gets greater, how does that confound this process? And Steve Kochman has developed some methodology that I think works to incorporate, so that we can incorporate multiple tests into this process in a pretty straightforward way. But as new and better tests come along, the genetic evaluations will change. But there's no magic that says if I have a carcass trait, it's worth so much relative to the ultrasound, relative to the MBV, because really how much each of those is worth depends on how much data the rest and how much pedigree connectedness and all of the things that go into that analysis. There's no carcass gets 0.4 and ultrasound gets 0.3 and MBV gets 0.3. It really varies depending on the circumstance of the particular animals or particular set of animals and the data that inform their EPD. I hope I said we need to have that carcass data. If we don't have that carcass data, then we've got a myriad of problems, of which that is one. I think we need to continue to collect phenotypes, and I don't see that need to collect phenotypes going away anytime soon. Is that a fair appraisal, Dick? The, The comment about accuracy was that accuracies are all approximations. And the modification was to do a better approximation. Now the ramification, well, some of the ramifications of this, we had bulls with ultrasound evaluation accuracies of 0.9 plus. And when they got shifted over to the carcass basis, that accuracy went down markedly. If they didn't have a fair bit of carcass data to support their accuracy at a level on the carcass evaluation. If you had an animal that was not well connected to carcass data, but in the data set with a lot of ultrasound data, his accuracy, because that genetic correlation is 0.6 roughly, when you expressed it on a carcass basis for the same conceptual trait, went down to the 0.4, 0.5 kind of range. And that came as a pretty good shock to a fair number of people, actually, to watch those accuracies decay. That's right. I mean, it's because we treated that trait as an indicator trait rather than as a trait of interest directly. Clearing it back. No, that's the MBV for the product, in this case the Igenity product.
Okay, so it's a smaller panel.
It's a reduced panel. In terms of the formula itself, I mean, the big piece of what was done was that the accuracy that had historically been an ultrasound-based accuracy that was very high gets changed because now the accuracy is relative to a carcass trait and the ultrasound is only an indicator of that. That's the big piece of what happened. And then because of increased computing power, you're able to implement a little more sophisticated formula and so on. But the expectation of that new accuracy is not, I mean, it still has the expectation of being the true accuracy. It's just a slightly better approximation. But the big piece is because of the philosophical change from trait of interest to indicator trait for a different trait of interest.